The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Yeah. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. But once she grabs, she won't let go. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
None of that soft stuff.
Rock, rock.
None of that heavy metal stuff.
Rock, rock, rock and Nicole.
Just a little bit of jazz.
Rock, rock, rock and Nicole.
What do you think?
Just I
like
love
that.
It. That was great. Thank you.
All right. Well, welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome to a Monday. A brand new week. I hate the start of a new week for a number of reasons. You don't need me to recount them. I'm sure you have your own reasons why you hate Monday. Like, for instance, I realized just now that, oh, shit, I never fixed the camera angle. So what happened last week is one of my monitors died. My main monitor just like crapped out, stopped working. So I needed to get a new one. And of course, I went to the marketplace on the Facebooks because a new monitor was going to be too expensive. So I wound up getting a really nice used 27-inch monitor for $50. But it's bigger than my other one was. So where I had the camera placed doesn't work because the monitor's in the way. And now I just can't get a decent shot. So I'm still working on it. So every day when you tune in, you'll probably see a different angle. You know, we'll get there. It is what it is. Just one more little hurdle that I have to deal with. Thankfully, I'm not having to deal with the bigger hurdle that I thought I would be dealing with today because the winds went a little bit to the west. Hurricane Ian is right now, I guess, thrashing Cuba. And it's creating storms here. I mean, it is kind of nasty outside. It's been raining on and off all day. And we're probably getting the outer bands. For those who don't know, I'm in southeast Florida. I'm in a town called Coral Springs. And we're not at the coast. We're about as far inland as you can get before you hit the Everglades. But still, so consider the East Coast, though. This storm, Ian, looked like it was coming straight at us. And then each day, like over the weekend, it edged a little further to the west. So now the models have us completely out of the cone of influence or whatever they call it. There are a number of different models. It's really hard to pinpoint exactly where a storm like this is going to go, and especially a storm that's this big. It's another big one. So we will get hit with some of the outer bands. But as far as it making, you know, landfall, it's going to go up the west coast of Florida, and it's looking like it's going to hit sometime maybe late tomorrow, early Wednesday, in the Tampa Bay region. So, and they're saying this is a big, slow-moving storm. It's going to dump a lot of rain, a lot of water, and flooding. And that's what's been happening with these storms. So Puerto Rico and, believe it or not, Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, I'm trying to remember how they pronounce it, Newfoundland, are cleaning up. Canada has never been hit by a storm with the damage that Fiona did. So, you know, for the first time in like 60 years, we made it through August without a named storm. But September is making up for it. Yeah. So anyway, it looks like, knocking on wood, laminate, that we here in southeast Florida maybe got lucky. And the storm is going around to the west. But Florida will be hit. It's going to be an ugly storm. And believe it or not, this is how lucky DeSantis is. DeSantis, piece of shit that he is, has been in office almost 4 years. And go figure, while he's been in office, there has not been a major storm to hit Florida. Yeah, we've been lucky the last few years. And honestly, between you and me, I'd rather not hear what DeSantis, you know, has to say about anything. So, hopefully, hopefully this storm will be not so horrible, and we can kind of move on. I want to tell you, though, about something else that's happening today, because it'll be right after this show ends, and it is a natural phenomenon. Well, no, it isn't actually a natural phenomenon. This is a man-made thing all the way. You know how there's like a new focus on NASA after so many years of no launches from NASA? By the way, they're going to start trying to launch that that other rocket, the one that was scrubbed a few weeks ago. That's coming. Artemis 1. But this isn't about that. No. What's happening today is really interesting. It's a program called DART. Wait, let me pull up my notes here so I can explain what the acronym means. DART stands for... Okay, now I got to find my notes on this one. Where is it? DART. Come on, DART. Okay. Double Asteroid Redirection Test. So do you remember, I didn't watch any of these movies, but there was one like, maybe it was Independence Day or something, where there was an asteroid heading for Earth, right? That was going to destroy the planet. Well, check this out. NASA at 5:30 this afternoon is going to go live at nasa.gov. So this will be streamed. They're sending up, actually this vehicle has been making its way toward this asteroid since last November it launched. It's the DART spacecraft. DART is the acronym for Double Asteroid Redirection Test. Got it? This DART mission is targeting a space rock, I guess an asteroid, called Dimorphos, which is 525 feet across. And the spacecraft is barreling towards it at 15,000 miles per hour. And what they're going to do is crash it. NASA is going to crash this vehicle that's the size of a bus, apparently, into an asteroid out in the middle of space. They sent this rocket, this vehicle, up November of 2021. It's carrying what they call an imager that will share a live stream of photographs as it nears the asteroid, providing what they describe as a video-like experience for viewers. A live broadcast will kick off on NASA's website at nasa.gov beginning at 6 p.m. Eastern tonight. So when this show ends, I may not end. I may just flip over to NASA's stream. It'll last until 7:30 tonight, and perhaps we will see... you know, the 21st century version of a demolition derby, right? Rocket blasting into an asteroid. Hey, it's never been done before. Sounds exciting to me. I'll watch that, right? So we'll see what happens there. It can't be any less disastrous than everything else that's going on in our world right now. So, something different to experience. Okay, I see our guest, well, at least one of our guests is here, but I'm going to wait just a moment. I'm excited. Cory Doctorow is back today. Now, Cory's been on the program before. We've talked about things, you know, sexy topics like antitrust laws and copyright and streaming problems and Digital Millennium Copyright Act and digital rights management and stuff like that. And we're going to kind of talk about those today as they relate to his new book. So the book actually hits stores tomorrow. Tomorrow's the official release date of, and I want to get it right, so bear with me while I bring it up, Checkpoint Capitalism, How Big Tech and Big Content Captured Creative Labor Markets, and How We'll Win Them Back. Now, you know, if you've been listening to this program for any amount of time, you know that I deal with, they're both in the same place. I see now. Okay. You know that I deal with a lot of tech gremlins. I've got the gremlins that that invade my show all the time. And as I try to stream video and audio and try to do try to not get caught up with all the the rules that keep us from doing what we do. You know what? I'm talking in circles. It's going to be easier if I just bring in our guests. So hold on 1 second. I got to get our titles up, and hopefully this all works. As I say, welcome back to Cory Doctorow, and welcome to Rebecca Giblin. Hi, guys. Can you hear me okay?
We hear you fine. This is our first time trying to do one of these two-up video shoots, so forgive us if we were.
Oh, this is perfect. No, it's perfect, and it's actually better because I don't use Zoom in the way that they expect you to use it. I always have to make things more difficult, and I thought you'd be on two separate video shots, so I had you. I was fudging it to get it all together, and then I see you're in the same place. That makes it much easier for me, anyway. So, hi, Rebecca. We haven't met. Thank you for joining us. Now, your name actually is above Corey's on the book. What? How did you guys split up? What is the relationship for the book Choke Point Capitalism?
Oh, well, we were the creation story for this book, the origin story, all began in a taxi in Melbourne back at the start of 2018. And we'd worked together just a tiny little bit before, but in that taxi ride, we were realizing that we were both seeing the problem in exactly the same way. There's always this kind of false dichotomy presented to us when we talk about these issues around getting creators paid, about are you on the side of creators or are you on the side of users? And we were both saying, well, that doesn't work at all. That's not what it's really about. The problem is that we've got these big businesses, big content and big tech, who are using their power to shape down creators and creative suppliers like publishers and independent record labels and get everything that they can. And so that's where it was born. And then that was really the germ of the idea. And it wasn't until early 2020 when the world was canceled, and so was the rest of what I had planned for the year. And I sort of saw that as a moment of freedom. Well, what do I actually want to work on now instead of what had I planned a year or two ago that I would work on now? And it was this story, the one that I felt like I really had to tell. So I started work on it, and then a couple weeks in of like very like exhilarating but frustrating and amazing work, I thought, this would be much better if Cory Doctorow wrote it with me. Anyway, I dropped him an email, and eventually here we are.
Yeah, we decided that we would try and come up with a way to break the deadlock that normally comes up where people say, do you want more rights for creators or fewer rights for creators? And instead talk about the kinds of rights for creators and for other kinds of workers that will actually put, you know, groceries on the table rather than just, you know, this kind of reflexive idea that all you want to do is get more copyright or longer copyright or easier to enforce copyright. Instead, we wanted to get the kind of copyright that actually makes a material difference to creators' lives and gets rid of these choke points. It's not checkpoint capitalism, it's choke point capitalism.
Right. Can you describe what choke point capitalism
is? Sure. Let me fix my camera here first a little. Try and get the angle better. Sorry, as I say, this is our first time setting this up. So choke point capitalism is the idea that firms can use some combination of law and contract and technology to corral an audience. So, you know, you think about your relationship to YouTube, say, where really if you want to reach people, there's a couple, three services you can use, Twitch, YouTube, maybe one or two smaller ones. And if you don't want to use any of those, you basically cut your audience by maybe 9/10. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the companies that control those choke points can extract big concessions from you. It kind of doesn't matter how much copyright we give you. You're still gonna face those concessions. Giving someone who has to go through a choke point more copyright is like giving a bullied kid more lunch money. It's not going to get them fed, right? You need to actually do something about the structure of the market.
Right. In fact, at the beginning of the book, you have a great analogy about the kid that you give $5 each day for lunch, and he goes to school, but the bullies take the lunch money. And you explain that the answer is not giving him more money, because then they'll just take away more. They'll take away more money. So that's what this book is for, to explain how to make that lunch money go as far as it needs to go and not give in to the bullies along the way.
Well, that's That's the thing that's different about this book. We're really tired. There's so many books out there that we call chapter 11 books, that you spend the first 10 chapters bemoaning the problem, how terrible everything is, wringing our hands. And then chapter 11, oh, well, we've kind of run out of space and a few hand wavy. Maybe we could do this kind of ideas for change. We decided to do it differently. And yes, we set up the first half of the problem to persuade you that the problem is not that there's not enough copyright or not enough whatever, but that there is a power imbalance, that these choke points are the problem. But then the whole second half of the book, we set out detailed, shovel-ready solutions that people can adopt into different kinds of creative industries in order to actually get more money into artists' pockets.
And I love that your concentration is on the creative artist, because there's a lot of people out there just struggling to get by. And then we maybe thought that with the advent of the internet, the great equalizer, everyone's going to have a chance at being heard, being seen, getting their stuff out there. But it doesn't work that way, because as you point out, and Corey, you've been pointing out for a while now, there's just a handful of companies. Consolidation has taken over to the point where regardless of what segment of the society you're looking at, chances are it's all controlled by, you know, if you're lucky, three or four or five companies. In many cases, it's more like one or two or three, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us remember the promise of those early years of the internet. And, you know, it's true that the early years of Napster and other file sharing did really do some damage to the livelihoods of creators and especially smaller labels. But it also opened up all kinds of new ways for people to distribute. And it seemed for a while like maybe we would be getting rid of these gatekeepers. Certainly, it made the labels that survived a lot more concerned about making sure that they cut a good deal for the artists who might be able to go it on their own. But over time, what we saw was that the tech industry became as consolidated as the entertainment industry. And moreover, in many cases, they sort of merged, whether that's Amazon being a publisher or the labels taking significant interest in Spotify. And it's a bit like the final scene of Animal Farm. This is a spoiler alert in case you haven't read a 70-year-old book by George Orwell. But at the end of Animal Farm, you know, the pigs who have led the revolution decide that they're actually going to throw their lots in with the farmers who were their enemies. And as the animals peer in the window of the farmhouse, they look from the pigs to the men and the men to the pigs, and they can't see the difference.
Right. And yes, I mean, it feels that way, right? You know, Corey and I have spoken before, Rebecca, so pardon me if we go over familiar territory here, but just to bring the listeners full circle, you know, I come from the world of music radio. And my world started falling apart in 1996 when Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act, which mm-hmm. upended all the rules on ownership, ownership levels. Starting there, it used to be that one company could own one AM, one FM, and one TV in a market with a limit of seven of each total in the whole country. Well, now they can do that in one market. They can own seven AM. They can own eight radio stations. They can own more than one television station and a newspaper. It used to be they realized that the a variety of voices was necessary in a real democracy, that the more voices meant more discussion, more freedom, more. But now there are no controls. So one voice, one media voice could own pretty much every radio station, TV, and newspaper in a market, and that's okay. My radio career continued on the downslide when the internet came up and stations were being sold and groups were shrinking, and where one company would own now eight. My last place was Los Angeles, and my last station was sold because one group merged with Clear Channel, merged with AM/FM, and again they had too many stations, so they were going to sell mine, which at the time was two smaller signals in Santa Monica and Newport Beach, both at 103.1. And so we convinced the higher ups at Clear Channel to let us be the first station to go seamlessly from over the air to internet only. And we did. And then the dot-com bust happened. So we were too early. But there are so many restrictions on what you can and can't do if you're going to play music on the internet. There are rules from this Digital Millennium Copyright Act that have no bearing on anything. It was internet was in its infancy, and yet those rules still dictate what's happening today, now almost 20 years later. Is it part of the problem that legislation and just rulemakers can't keep up with the technology? Or is that a totally different issue?
You know, I think that that's oversold. I confess that I've been as guilty as the next sort of smug millennial of accusing old politicians of not being smart enough to regulate the internet. We all laughed when Ted Stevens talked about dump trucks and series of tubes. But the reality is, you know, there's no microbiologists in Congress, and yet somehow we can drink our tap water if we live outside of Flint. And that's not because they have all done their reading. It's because it is possible to make laws about highly technical subjects through expert regulation and rulemaking. What's happened instead over not just the last 20 years since the Clinton years, but over the last 40 years since the Reagan years, is a tolerance for monopoly. Reagan decided 40 years ago that the problem with monopolies wasn't that they could screw over their workers or that they could corrupt the political process. It was that, in his view, a small minority of monopolies were inefficient and would raise prices, and that regulators should only ever attend to these, and that most of the time, even if it looked like a monopolist was raising prices, they probably weren't. It's probably all in your imagination. And 40 years later, we ended up with so much consolidation across every sector, and it was bipartisan. It was, as you say, George Clinton, or Bill Clinton. I always mix them up with George Clinton. Bill Clinton signed the Telecoms Act, and you know, Obama oversaw many giant mergers. And it really wasn't until Biden that you saw some really muscular antitrust enforcement. And I don't know that it's Biden personally feeling this way, but certainly the appointments that he made because of the internal politics of the Democratic Party, the head of the FTC, rather, Lina Khan, the DOJ's head of antitrust, Cantor, and Tim Wu in the White House, right, have all been a real powerhouse and have surrounded themselves with a staff and have become part of a global movement to rein in monopoly everywhere. And, you know, monopoly is very bad, but monopsony, which is what we write about, which is when not just when there's a small number of sellers, but when there's a small number of buyers, is even more dangerous. I don't know, Rebecca, you like to talk about this.
Yeah, so monopsony becomes problematic at way lower market concentrations than monopoly. So a buyer that controls just 8 or 10% of the market can have a lot of power over sellers. So when we're talking about buyers, we're talking about Amazon when it's dealing with publishers, Apple and Google when they're dealing with software developers, mm-hmm. And things like that. And if we think about this in the context of just, you know, and the radio industry, for example, this increase in monopoly and monopsony that we've seen over the last 40 years, we can see a number of ways in which it's playing out. So one of the things, of course, has been that there has been that shuttering of those local stations, which makes it much more difficult for emerging artists to break through in ways that are not coming through those sort of centralized choke points like the major record labels, Spotify's playlists and things like that. We also see it in the fact that big radio has been able to defeat literally dozens of bills to require radio stations to pay royalties when there are the sound recordings played. And the United States is in an extremely exclusive club on that internationally. The other members are Iran, North Korea, and Rwanda, maybe one or two others. But just to give you an idea where that sits.
Wow. You know, we don't, when I'm saying we, I'm talking about the government when they write these laws, I guess, or when they don't do something to protect us. And Corey, I know that last time you and I spoke, we were very optimistic because there were these new antitrust bills being brought up, but has there been any progress? Because I don't notice anything happening since then.
What there's been is a lot of administrative progress and not much legislative progress. You may have noticed, but Congress has become pretty dysfunctional for reasons that are like not directly related to antitrust.
Right.
The rise and fall of the suite of it must be said, a mixed bag, but some very excellent tech antitrust bills in the American Congress is unrelated to the merits for those or the political will for them. I think it has a lot more to do with January 6th. So. But what we have seen is that there is an extremely competent set of administrators on the antitrust side. So Tim Wu, who runs the White House antitrust efforts, ghost wrote an executive order for Biden in the summer 2020, enumerating 72 things that the president and the administration could do without congressional approval on antitrust. And they set out a timeline to do all of them, and they've hit their marks on every single one of them. And they made another set of announcements today where we're going to see there's like a 19th century meatpacking law that's going to be invoked for the first time in 75 years. That's going to free up chicken farmers who are among the most exploited workers in the world from the abusive relationships they have with chicken plants. There's going to be something else on hidden fees and pay and telephone bills and so on. So there's been a lot of action. And what's more important, I think, is that internationally, there's been a lot of coordination and cooperation. So the Europeans have introduced and passed the Digital Markets Act, which is going to require interoperability in tech platforms. So you're going to be able to plug in new app stores to your iPhone, and you're going to be able to connect new services to existing ones. But they're also opening up a bunch of investigations into tech companies. Now, they don't have a lot of staff to do that with. They're underfunded. But in the UK across the channel, its parliament is also very dysfunctional. So they managed to create a budget for antitrust without creating antitrust powers for the agency. So their Competition and Markets Authority has 80 full-time engineers, but no enforcement powers. So those engineers have basically been pursuing deep investigations into tech monopolies that are then being used by the Europeans, who have a lot of powers, but no investigators to go after the companies. So we're seeing a real kind of international coalition of the willing here. Even the Chinese cyberspace directive has got some tech antitrust in it. I think all over the world, there's this understanding that tech giants are standing up for tech giants, not for the countries they come from, not for the workers who produce their materials, not for anything except their shareholders' interests.
Right.
And those international interventions have a lot of promise, because what we're seeing is that when an international regulator takes action, and we've seen that with a few countries against Apple with its App Store, well, then Apple might just change its policies for the whole world, because it ends up being just too annoying to try and have different ones across different countries. So if we can achieve more through these international interventions, that's one way of creaking open these choke points, widening them out throughout the entire world.
Right. And tell me if this doesn't apply. I think it does. There was recently a new law passed, or a new avenue. So people, if you own Apple, I'm not an Apple person, but you couldn't take your phone or iPad or computer to your local shop. If it broke, you had to go to an Apple authorized dealer to get something fixed. Well, now you have the right to repair. This is something that we had to have a law passed for?
So it wasn't a law. The FTC opened a proceeding, and there was an administrative, an executive order as well. The laws have actually been roundly defeated. There were 18 of them introduced at the state level in 2018 and 20 plus in 2019. And they were killed by a sort of unholy coalition of like John Deere and GM and Apple, and even Wahl, the company that makes the shavers. Uh-huh. They've started booby trapping the shaver heads of their clippers with a spring loaded mechanism. So if you take them apart to sharpen them, they fly apart, and you have to send them back to the factory to have them put back together again. So this weird coalition came together to kill all these state law. But you know, no matter how many of these state laws they kill, people really want to fix their own stuff. So we've seen some limited state laws on right to repair. There was a New York one on electronics. Much more interesting, actually, is the Colorado one on powered wheelchairs, where, again, this is another one of these choke points, but for something else, where all the power wheelchairs in America are made by two companies, because Medicare has a lower bidder policy, so they've all consolidated. Medicare only pays for indoor chairs, but of course people who have powered wheelchairs like to go outside, and they don't pay for preventative maintenance. And the private equity-backed monopolies that have cornered the market on chairs have cut their maintenance budgets. So there's almost it's very hard to get your chair fixed. And you can be confined to bed for months at a time while you wait for minor repairs to be on your chair. So Jared Polis, the governor of Colorado, signed in a new antitrust law that guarantees the right to repair your wheelchair, your powered wheelchair, in the state of Colorado. And, you know, I think what this all comes to is what we get at in the last chapter of the book, which is that although we're writing about entertainment labor markets, that there are a lot of labor markets that look like this. And there are a lot of other kinds of markets that look like this, where you have excessive corporate power, excessive buyer power, and not enough worker power. And that the way that we're going to make a difference is not by creative workers coming together on their own. There is power in that. We give some examples of some really effective recent labor solidarity movements, but by making cross-sectoral alliances, by having solidarity with Uber drivers who are in the most choke point of all choke point capitalisms, and with nurses and with lots of other kinds of workers who are situated like entertainment workers, like creative workers, who do the work not just because they expect to get paid for it, but because they love it. Right. And that's something we share with teachers and nurses. And teachers and nurses' bosses understand, like our bosses understand, that even if you abuse your workers, they'll still show up for work because they love the work and they feel a duty to do it.
Right. And one of
my favorite parts in the book, actually, is that material on worker solidarity.
You froze on me. There you go. Okay. You're back again. You froze for a second, then you're back. There's something down the line because you froze again. When they come back up, we're speaking with Cory Doctorow and Rebecca Giblin. Together, they've written the new book, Choke Point Capitalism. I can't
hear you. You're getting a peek at the sausage being made, but I'll get that on. We might drop for 1 second, but we should be back if we.
And we were back, and now we're frozen again. But hopefully this will come back again in a moment. It's the internet. You see, there are glitches and there are gremlins. They will be back, I'm sure. By the way, you can find Cory Doctorow at craphound.com. That is his regular website. And I think you're back now. There you are.
Yeah, we are. I'm sorry. I was just getting my backup network connection online here.
No worries at all. Yes.
I was just telling this story of, Uber drivers and other sort of delivery people are some of the most powerless people, powerless workers that we have, especially in the way that they get falsely categorized as being independent contractors and all kinds of abuses like that. One of the abuses that they're subject to are these contracts that take away their rights to class actions. So effectively, that is taking away their rights, access to justice when there are abusive practices, because it's prohibitive for any one individual to pay the costs of an action on their own behalf in this kind of circumstance. And so the only way that it's possible is when they band together and bring a class action. When contracts prohibit them from doing so, they tend to be given something called mandatory commercial arbitration instead. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that they go into these private administrative proceedings to have grievances heard. They are paid for by the company. And we know from the research that the adjudicators of these have their thumb pressed on the scale on the side of the big business that actually pays their wages. They don't have any precedential value, which means that they can't be leveraged very well into helping other workers. Now, faced with these circumstances, tens of thousands of these workers all coordinated to bring private arbitration actions against these companies at exactly the same time. And what while it's way cheaper for the companies to defend one commercial arbitration than one class action, boy, is it expensive for them to have to defend tens of thousands of them, prohibitively expensive. And these companies ran to the court saying, oh no, this is so unfair. We're being bullied by these people who are all like being mean to us by bringing these actions at the same time. Please make them stop, because this was supposed to be better for us, not worse. Now, in the end, Uber actually had to settle with most of its workers on this for $150 million. Wow. And so that kind of solidarity and jujitsu by workers to show that they do have power when they work together, and finding ingenious ways of doing that, is the kind of hopeful and inspiring thing that we write about in the book.
Well, good. And I want to get into that part of the book, what the solutions are, because great, we know the problem. We could talk about the problem forever. The question is, how do we fix it? But I want to share with you just a minute long clip. I mostly talk about politics and news, but I still keep a foot in music because I love music. And that's, I come from music radio. There's an artist, a wonderful singer-songwriter named Dar Williams, who was on my show on Friday. I don't know if you're familiar with her or not. You should be. She's great. And she's got a book out, a new book out called How to Write a Song That Matters. because she does songwriting workshops. And as we're talking, we get on. She taught a college course at Wesleyan. And I was intrigued by what it was about. And I'm going to let you hear how she describes it. Because, again, she's a folk artist. She's a singer-songwriter. She's been at it for three decades, but, you know, the struggle that an independent artist has. So here's what she told me about her college course.
The college course I taught came before, and quite instrumentally, because it was called Music Movements in a Capitalist Democracy.
Right. I'm looking at it now.
Because it was going to be called Music Movements in a Democracy. But, you know, I was thinking about how in Canada, there's so much more. They have the healthcare paid for. Yes. They have a rule about Canadian content. They support their festivals. They support recording artists and tours. It's different than the sink or swim, you know. And I have to say, I remember you from Starbucks. Okay. And before.
So we were talking about, because I knew her, we did a radio show together almost 30 years ago. And I was helping her, you know, navigate some of the ins and outs of the music industry. And what she goes on to say is, I didn't want to do a songwriting workshop because I don't want to deal with the business of the music industry, like getting a deal or anything. I just want to deal with writing a song that matters. But this course was about songwriting in a capitalized democracy. And she pointed out how they do it in Canada, where they're very supportive of the artist. When I first found out that they had quotas on how many Canadian artists a radio station had to play before they could bring in others, what the ratio of it was, and how supportive they are. And I was amazed. And then I find that is, you know, that countries who care about their artists do stuff like that.
Yeah, and it's actually even worse than that. So not only are there fewer sort of cultural subsidies in the United States, but the monopoly and monopsony problem directly results in songwriters getting treated even worse than they would otherwise. So the three big record labels control almost 70% of the global recorded music market. And they happen to own the three major music publishers, which control almost 60% of the song rights. Now, the way that so that creates just an enormous conflict.
You
of interest.
I want to jump in for a second because you say the three record labels, and people are going, wait a minute, there's more than three. There's, you know, there's Interscope and there's Def Jam and but there's all these little labels that are owned by the big labels, and it's like a pyramid, and they keep buying up the little indie guys. And so, what is it? Universal Music Group, Sony Music, and one other,
and Warner's.
And Warner's. Duh, that's it. That's it.
Yeah, that's it. And so there's this huge conflict of interest that comes from the record labels owning the music publishers that really, we think, is impacting the way that the publishers get, that the composers get paid. Because just the way that the business is set up, if you were to pay them equally, which is how it works in some places and under some contracts, then more of the money is actually going to go to the composer, whereas if you pay it to the recording artist, it's going to stay within the record label. And that comes down to a con called recoupment. And not many people know this about how a recording contract works, but I'm going to talk particularly about how it was structured around 2000, where we've got some of the more egregious practices.
Okay.
So around that time, maybe you were getting a royalty rate of, you know, maybe 7 or 9%. And it's going to cost you and your bandmates, say there's four of you, you know, you need a little bit of money to live on. You need some money to record the record and to pay for some promotional costs and so on. That's going to maybe take you a couple years. Let's call that $150,000. Now, the way it works in music recording is that all of that money gets totted up as a debt that you owe to the label. And then you have to repay that debt out of your 7% or 9% royalty that you get on each record. And depending on, you know, how much the record cost and what the royalty is exactly, it can cost easily $3 million for you to repay your $150,000, like $3 million of revenues before you've paid back your notional $150,000 debt to the label. And so by structuring streaming deals, for example, so that most of the money goes to the recording artists and less goes to the songwriters, that happens to work out very well because those debts are almost never recouped. And the record labels almost never actually have to pay out more money to those artists. They just keep taking it and taking it. And the royalty rates are much better now because we do have competition from alternative distribution platforms for current deals. But the old deals, which were all for the life of the copyright, there are deals from the 60s and 70s that are still ongoing today. And sometimes those people are only earning a notional royalty rate of 3 or 4%. And that's all, even though the backlist on the streaming platforms can be very, very popular, all of that money is going directly into the coffers of those record labels. And they still don't have to pay out. I think it's only Sony, actually, that has agreed to reform this and write off old recruitment debts.
Really?
So that some of these legacy musicians actually finally get a paycheck after decades.
Yes.
At the time we went to print, at least, Universal and Warner was still refusing to do that.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, yeah, this neatly dovetails into some of the solutions from the back half of the book. And I want to stress again that, you know, we devoted fully half of the book to technical solutions, and that they're not solutions that individuals can take. I know the feeling, right? You read a book that is full of horrible things that are going on. You know, you read Silent Spring and you find out about all the birds dying because of DDT. And you're like, well, what can I do? What if I just stop putting DDT on my plants? It's not going to solve the problem. Solve the DDT problem was a ban on DDT. And, you know, in the same way that you can't recycle your way out of climate change, you can't individually shop your way out of monopoly. And so what we propose are structural answers, right? So things that local governments can do. And we do have a chapter, you know, you mentioned the Canadian content rules. I am Canadian. We're like serial killers. We're everywhere and we look just like everybody else. We have a chapter on how a local government working with its local library has produced incredible dividends for local artists making their own streaming service.
Wow.
And so there are things local governments can do. There are things state governments can do. So, for example, nearly all the contracts involving entertainment products are consummated in New York or in California or in Washington State because of Amazon. And so there's a lot of space for a state legislature to act. You know, if we reform the contract laws in those three states so that there's no non-disclosure when you find accounting irregularities in your royalty statement, then if you find out that your label's been ripping you off or your publisher or your studio, which happens all the time. We reference someone in the book who's had tens of thousands of these audits, and they found that there are innumerable instances in which wages are being stolen from creators, and only one instance in all of those in which it turned out that the label had made a mistake in the favor of the creator and to its own detriment. This is an incredible coincidence. Wow. I think you'll understand, you'll agree that it seems almost impossible to believe, but yet somehow this is the case. So if we just said, okay, there's no more enforceable non-disclosure in contracts for this kind of accounting irregularity, then if you find six figures in money that's owed to you, as one of our sources did, you can go tell all the other people who are signed to similar deals with your label, hey, this is where your stolen money is. You should go ask for it.
Wow.
But in the case of these old contracts that have worse terms, there's another thing we can do, which is called termination. And the termination right was written into the 1976 Copyright Act. It was substantially watered down from the original proposal. It's actually a very old idea in American copyright. The first American copyright law lasted for 14 years, and then only the creator could renew it for another 14 years. So if you signed a deal with your publisher that wasn't very good because they were buying a pig and a poke, they didn't know if your book would sell well, but after 14 years it was a bestseller, they had to come to you and get you to renew the copyright. And if you wouldn't renew the copyright, they wouldn't be able to have exclusive rights to the books anymore. And so that was a chance for you to get a second bite at the apple. Well, under US law today, you can, after 30 years, file some paperwork with the Copyright Office and say, I want to cancel that contract I had where I signed away my copyright forever. Even if it says you signed it away forever, you can cancel it. Now, it's full of carve-outs. It's technically very complicated, but it has served a bunch of artists who got bad deals originally and whose works are still commercially viable. Stephen King used it to cancel the deals on his first, you know, half dozen novels. Uh-huh. And it got him because he was a baby writer.
Right.
He wasn't Stephen King the Giant, right?
Right.
Now he's got a better deal on that. Every Sweet Valley High book, every Babysitter's Club book, they're all back in their creator's hands.
Wow.
George Clinton was able to cancel the assignments on all of his music. And so, you know, if we're worried about these Heritage Acts, and we should be because they signed some very bad deals, and although they are predominantly racialized, predominantly black artists, no one got a great deal. I mean, the Beatles used to have to split one penny between them for every album they sold.
And that was after paying their agent.
Yeah, they had to pay their agent. They had to hold back 15% for so they got 85% of a penny. 15% was withheld for promotional copies. And then they split that four ways after paying their agent 10%. And so, you know, even the Beatles got a raw deal. And so there's so much space to go in there and say, let's modify the terms of copyright, not to make it last longer or make the penalties harsher or make it easier to exact them, because that doesn't help you if the money from that doesn't land in the artist's pocket.
Right.
Let's figure out how to make these interventions in a way that actually helps working artists.
Yeah, and amending the termination law so that it does a much better job of that is a really great place to start. Because as Corey said, it's got all these carve-outs. It's really complicated. And particularly when it comes to those old record deals, the labels have been arguing that they don't apply to music deals under like some pretty wonky stuff I won't get into. And in fact, they were so determined to stop the termination law from benefiting recording artists that they stole the right to do so. That's what they tried. So first of all, when this law was passed in 1976, they hadn't managed to get sound recordings listed in the works that it wouldn't apply to, right? Then around 2000, just when we were starting to get, you know, within viewing distance of the time people would start to actually be able to cancel their deals, a congressional staffer called Mitch Glazier, in the dead of night, snuck in four little words into a completely unrelated bill, the Satellite Home Viewer Improvement Act, right, that added sound recordings to the list of works for hire that could be excluded from this, right?
Man.
Nobody noticed until it had been signed into law, and then all hell broke loose, right? And artists, the Copyright Office, law professors, artist advocates were all completely outraged. And the recording industry's like, oh, well, it's done now, so I guess.
And we're frozen again. Oh, God, it kills me. They'll be back in a second. Rebecca Gilbin and Cory Doctorow are our guests. We're talking about the new book, Choke Point Capitalism. It hits stores officially tomorrow. And
that's the backup network, too.
And here we go. We're back.
Don't worry about that.
That's Nicole, okay. Where did it we happens. Cut off? Because I was just at the bit I was most outraged about. I want to finish with that.
Well, go. Just keep going. You were talking about the
record industry stole the right for musical artists to take advantage of this.
Yes.
Right? Artists did mobilize, and after a year of concerted pressure, they finally managed to get it rolled back. But it's still very, very difficult to terminate a sound recording today because they argue that they fall within these other categories that are in the Act. And anytime someone's got deep enough pockets to actually litigate this, they settle it so there's no precedent that like more vulnerable artists can rely upon. And the cherry on top, if you were not outraged enough, that congressional staffer that I mentioned, who snuck in those words in the dead of night, was immediately recruited by the Recording Industry Association of America to go work for them. And today he's their chairman and CEO.
What is his name?
Mitch Glazier.
Oh, my goodness. I thought the name sounded familiar. Wow.
Our book is full of stories like this. Like, if you were not enraged enough about what's going on for creators, you're definitely going to be after you read about this. But also, we really do focus on these solutions and show so many great examples of the way that these atomized workers, these creative laborers, have managed to turn the tables and get more of the value of their work for themselves.
Right. Well, you do tell the story about, you know, I was familiar with the fact that old blues artists really never got anything for their work. I mean, it's one of the reasons Bonnie Raitt helped form the Rhythm and Blues Society, and she makes sure that money goes to these artists and songwriters because there was a need for it. You talk about in the early days of rap, for instance, there was a lot of sampling going on. And at the time, nobody sampled a 10-second, 20-second clip from a song that were being sampled and used in other songs. Well, somebody said, wait a minute, we can make money off of this, and started licensing snippets from songs. And this turned into a whole other cottage industry. It's like, how much can we milk out of this stone? And now, is that being fixed or not?
So what happened was, when in the early days of sampling, nobody thought that you needed a license to take a second or two of someone else's music. You know, when like Charlie Parker is blowing a solo and he puts a couple of bars of some other song in. He doesn't have a license for it. You know, when Ella Fitzgerald is scatting and she puts in, you know, a bit of Deo or a bit of That's Amore, right? No one gets a license for it. And so they were just doing the same thing, but with snippets of tape or bits off of vinyl records. And it was assumed to be okay. There are a couple of different legal theories for why. One is that it was fair use, but the other is that it was what was called de minimis, which is like just below the threshold for the law to trouble itself with. Like, it's not trespassing if your toe brushes your neighbor's lawn. It's right. You know, formally you might have broken the law, but it's de minimis. Just doesn't matter. And so that was the way we proceeded for a long time. We got a pretty incredible era in hip hop. You got albums like It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back from Public Enemy and Paul's Boutique from the Beastie Boys, which just had hundreds of samples, sometimes layered on top of each other.
Right.
Public Enemy liked to take, you know, six snare drums and lay them on top of each other to make a snare that sounded like no snare you'd ever heard. And just this really amazing stuff. And what happened was there were a couple of bad court cases that made it a lot more questionable about whether or not you were in the clear to do it. And the people who were publishing these albums decided that the safe thing to do was to just clear the samples, to just pay for it. And at first, that was pretty good news because a lot of these were heritage acts. A lot of the samples were taken from heritage acts. So old R&B artists who never got a very good deal. And their contracts were such that maybe that didn't fall under their recoupment, or maybe they had recouped, but there wasn't any new money coming in. And so that came in as new money over the transom. And for people who are really in dire shape, you know, just a couple of bags of groceries a year was a big difference. But almost immediately, the label saw an opportunity. What they started to do was amend their contracts so that every time you signed a record deal, you had to sign over those sample rights. So the revenues went to the label. And in order to license the samples, in order to get samples for your own composition, you had to be willing to or you had to be signed to a label, because the labels would only license to each other. And so it created this really amazing, vicious cycle where if you wanted to make sampling music, chances were the music you wanted to sample came from a label. So you had to sign to a label. You had to sign away your sampling rights. And then if someone wanted to sample you, they would have to sign to a label and sign away their sampling rights. And very quickly, we got to a world where nobody makes music that is legal of the sort that Public Enemy and Paul's Boutique made, right? That wasn't just that, and Beastie Boys made. That wasn't just that the tastes changed. What happened was that it became commercially prohibitive to make those albums. You know, Kembru McLeod and his colleague, Peter DiCola, wrote this great book where they calculate how much money Paul's Boutique and It Takes a Nation of Millions would hold us back would have lost if they did all those samples. It was millions of dollars.
I think they said that there was one quote that suggested that the albums would have to sell for about $240 each.
To cover the samples. So these were the most commercially successful hip-hop albums of all time when they did this study. And so, you know, a kind of music that people loved and that was commercially viable and that made money for artists disappeared. And then a new kind of music was created. And I like a lot of later hip hop music that has fewer samples. But I also like acts like Girl Talk that make illegal music, right? Music that samples without clearance. And it's contemporary music. It sounds as contemporary as anything else. And the musician who makes it is talented. And they deserve to be as compensated as the Beastie Boys were, as Public Enemy were. But they can only make music outside of the commercial realm because they're breaking the law every time they make music.
Wow. Now, you know, Cory Doctorow, you've been writing in this space and talking about this space. And for instance, your book, I know a lot of my listeners like to buy audiobooks. They cannot get Choke Point Capitalism through Audible, which is the biggest audiobook, supplier out there.
Monopolist and monopsonist.
Yes, these are
really a piece of work. Can we talk a little bit about Audible?
Please do. Yes, explain why.
Well, this is a classic example of a shakedown of artists. One of the stories that we write about is a scandal called Audiblegate. If you want to look it up, it's hashtag Audiblegate, and you can find out a little bit of information about this shocking wage theft scandal. But basically, independent writers and smaller publishers have to, in order to get their books onto Audible, they've got to go through an Audible own platform called ACX. And you have to get your books onto Audible, right? Because that is by far the biggest share of the market. So if you're not on Audible, you're really not going to make very much money. And Corey's agent tells him or has told him, you know what, mate, if you had only put your books on Audible, you would have paid off the mortgage on your house and you would have a college fund for your kid, right? Uh-huh. Neither of which has actually happened, but Corey won't work with them because of the ways in which they insist on mandatory DRM in order to lock in their users, which help them lock in their suppliers and also eliminate competition. So all the things we talk about in the book. But this other con that they were doing, they took that power that they got from having that lock-in through that DRM. And because creators had no other choice, they were able to do things like not give any kind of transparency around their sales. So the way that they were reporting it is they might say to an author, okay, you sold 3 books today. What they wouldn't say was, well, actually, you sold 13 books today, but 10 of them were returned. Because one of the ways that Amazon likes to lock in, or Audible likes to lock in listeners to the company, is by offering subscribers virtually unlimited rights to return those books for a full credit again.
Really?
Now, this has only been available to ongoing subscribers. So it is a way of really locking them in and keeping them into this ecosystem. But Audible was recovering that. And so I should say as well, it wasn't that you could return a book for a credit if you listened to the first few minutes and you didn't like it, or even, you know, the first few chapters. You could listen to the whole thing through. And you could love it. And you would be encouraged to return it, no questions asked, for a full credit, and basically use the service like a library.
Yeah, at the end of the listen, it would say, did you want to return this? Click here.
And so what was happening, and so they were hiding this from the authors by like having net sales instead of separating out the actual sales from the returns. And the only reason this came to light is because there was a data glitch that showed everybody 3 weeks of returns data all in a single day. And so suddenly authors were able to see, wow, this is massively affecting our bottom line. And so one author called Susan May realized that fully half of her book sales were being returned. And so she started this campaign to demand that Audible change their terms. And one of the other people that came on board with this was a woman called Colleen Cross, who had been a forensic accountant and then had switched careers to become the writer of financial fraud thrillers, which is actually a big thing. She's a very successful writer as well. Uh-huh. She started taking a magnifying glass, that forensic eye, to the royalties and having a look at, well, hang on a minute, if Audible's doing this with returns, what else are they doing to us? And she thinks, based on her analysis, and of course it's very different.
I'm hoping you're going to pop right back in. Again, another glitch. In the podcast, I'll edit it. But Rebecca Gilbert and Corey Doctorow, I'm sure, will be back with us momentarily. I don't know why the breaks in the internet here.
I think we're back.
You are back now. Yeah. Yep, there you are.
Yeah, this is, well, it's another Monopoly story. We've got Charter Spectrum. It's the old Monopoly carrier. And this is as good as it gets from good old Charter Spectrum.
Wow, I get it. I've dealt with AT&T forever, and now I have this Bluestream company that, since they switched to fiber, it's been better. But yeah, we're at their mercy again, and monopolies. So
So Rebecca was saying about Audible. Go ahead.
So that Colleen Cross estimates that instead of actually paying the authors the way that the contracts say they should, which already would have given Audible a massive share, that Audible's taking up to 87, 89% of every cent that's coming in for these books for independent authors. And what this amounts to between the return scam and what she's saying about the way the royalties are being mispaid is wage theft of hundreds of millions of dollars. And again, really difficult to take action against Amazon because of the way the contracts are formed. And of course, the sheer power of Amazon, or the Amazon Audible complex. But they have managed, through working together, to get some real reforms in terms of how the returns policy works, in terms of who pays for it when a book is returned, how long subscribers have to return a book, but also a little bit more transparency in how the sales are reported. And this shows us, like, it's again one of the solutions that we can demand. We can ask for more transparency. Okay, it's very, very difficult to fight an enemy if you can't see what they look like. And so we see from this story that once the authors knew what was going on, they were able to mobilize and to get at least some change, although we're still waiting for that fight to progress, and hopefully they're going to get more than that.
And I should mention that if you are an audiobook listener, although you can't get our work on Audible, you can get it everywhere else audiobooks are sold. It'll be on sale as of tomorrow, Kobo, Barnes & Noble, Google Play, Libro.fm, or...
And once again, Spectrum. you moved for a second and then it froze again. So it's good to know the audiobook is available, just not through Audible. And maybe this is a lesson. Maybe this says, you don't want to use Audible. There are other avenues to get your audiobooks, just like there are other places to buy things than Amazon.
Bobble, but this might, I'm now taking us right off the Wi-Fi altogether.
And there you are. You're back.
Here we go. So I was going to say, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Great. So we kickstarted this, the production for this, and we raised over $100,000 in pre-sales for the audiobook. And we got a wonderful reader, a guy named Stefan Rudnicki, who you may know as the voice of Ender from the Ender's Game books. He's done more than 1,000 audiobooks, and he co-owns a wonderful studio here in LA called Skyboat Media. He did an incredible job narrating it. And it was great to have our fans help us out with the audiobook. And we did put a little bit of it on Audible. So we have a chapter in the book about how Audible steals from creators, and we packaged it up as an Audible original, and we used ACX to publish it. We don't think you should buy it there, but you can get it there. We also have a chapter on how Spotify steals from artists. We made that a Spotify exclusive,
You
can get that on Spotify as well.
I'm not sure that we talk about how Spotify steals from artists, but definitely the moves that they're making to try and create trick points as well. Although there's plenty there about how record labels have also got some
collude with Spotify.
And structure the deal. The record labels have insisted over time on structuring deals in a way that get them the money and like divert it away from creators' pockets. So that recruitment scam we were talking about before, where they only have to share the tiniest amount with creators in the first place, wasn't enough. They also tried all of these other cons, which we detail in the book.
Of course they did. No. And it seems that they'll keep going and keep pushing and pushing until we push back enough that they have to stop and retreat, right?
So, yeah. And we is the right word there, that this is not an individual action. As you say, the book is really focused on these collective projects, these things that we have to do together as a polity that we can't just solve on our own.
Well, I thank you for doing the work and for writing this book. And Corey, I know you've been walking the talk for a long, long time. Rebecca, we're just meeting, but apparently you have as well. I know you're obviously from Australia. Are these same problems universal? Are they all over the world? Are the copyright laws and rules in each country different so that in some places it's better, like Canada, for the artist?
But they are different, and we're actually seeing some hopeful green shoots. For example, coming out of Europe in 2019, they passed the Digital Single Market Directive that has some really encouraging new rights for creators. So, for example, it includes transparency rights over pay and revenues and use of the work, so artists and performers can find out about that. It includes mandates for fair remuneration, right, which is like a minimum wage for creative work.
Please, yeah. And
it also includes reversion rights or termination rights, which in the event that the works are no longer being commercially exploited, then member states have got to give their artists the right to be able to get those works back. So these are really encouraging models. They build upon other European laws that have been operating and successful for a number of years now. And we're definitely, well, certainly in my work, it's a lot about building the evidence about whether this kind of intervention works. And certainly there is a growing amount that they do.
Well, I hope so. One little thing I'm noticing, I'm hoping that what I'm seeing is actually happening. YouTube apparently is tweaking things. I was invited to this like a focus group kind of thing for creators who do play sound files illegally on YouTube. Occasionally I'll use music, like with Dar Williams the other day. So she played a song and I played something from a few years ago where she played songs. And when I do that, I never know if I'm going to get copyright violated. Sometimes they'll do the content sharing, so they take any revenue that I might earn, which I'm fine with. Or in the worst case scenario, especially if it's a Don Henley song, they'll block the video and will give me a copyright strike and get me suspended from streaming on YouTube for 3 months. But now I notice with the Dar Williams, they wrote out each song that I used and said they will be sharing the revenue in these. Great. That's what I wanted all along. Let me pay so I can play an artist's music, but know that mechanism didn't exist. Maybe they're working towards that now. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely YouTube has announced some improvements this week. It's funny because it's two steps forward, one step back. Yeah. The same week, Twitch announced some major regressions in how they treat their artists. Wow. So, you know, Twitch is a division of Amazon. They've been part of Amazon since 2014. And that acquisition was supposed to be strategic in the sense that the Amazon would be able to do something for Twitch that Twitch as a standalone platform couldn't do on its own. The obvious thing would be providing Twitch with bandwidth because Amazon Web Services is one of the largest providers of hosting in the world, right? Streaming in the world. It's, you know, Netflix's back end and so on. And it's also the major variable cost in running Twitch, right? The cost of developing the Twitch software is the same whether you have one creator or a million creators or one viewer or a million viewers. But the cost of serving those streams changes based on how many viewers you have. And so it's the thing where in order to grow, they need to get it ever more cheaply. So this week they announced that, or last week rather, that they were going to cut the pay of their highest paid creators. So their split with creators is 50-50, which is already ghastly. The idea that they take half the money you earn. Yeah. But it turns out that they had offered sneaky sweetheart deals to their most valuable creators of 70-30. And they said, well, you know, this is really unfair. Some creators shouldn't get 70% while others get 50, which is true. But it does ask this question, why don't we just give everyone 70%? Right. But they had an answer.
And their answer was,
Amazon charges us too much for bandwidth. Well, hold on. Are you saying, as Sam Sater from The Intercept said, that Amazon, or is that Sam Biddle rather? Yeah, Amazon has to take money from Amazon because Amazon charges Amazon too much money to run the service, and that's why they've got to cut streamers' wages. And you know, it raises the question, right? What was the strategic part of that deal? Was it that they could get cheaper bandwidth, or was it that once they had a monopoly, they could get cheaper labor?
It's like the chicken and the egg. There you go. It's the age-old question.
It's like the chicken in the pot.
There are that, too. Cory Doctorow, Rebecca Giblin, thank you so much. We're in overtime now. I've kept you longer than I should have. I appreciate your work so much. This book is really important. Choke Point Capitalism.
Nicole, could I just mention as well?
I'm sorry, yes?
Sorry, just finally, we've got an event tomorrow night in LA for the listeners, maybe to the live program, or if you've got friends in LA or artists that you know that like might be interested in hearing us live, if you just look up Book Soup and our names or Choke Point Capitalism, you'll find the details for that. It would be so great to see some people there.
And Cory, I see you're going to be down here in Miami at Books and Books on October 12th.
That's true. I will be.
It's a great bookstore and it's a great venue for authors to come and speak at. It's like the only one of its kind down here.
So. I love Coral Gables. It's going to be great.
It is going to be great. October 12th for that tomorrow night in Los Angeles. I do have a lot of people in LA. I did radio.
Beverly Hills Public Library, 7 p.m.
Yeah, please come and say hi.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. What a pleasure this is, and I appreciate your work.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Again, the book, Choke Point Capitalism. And let me clear the screen so we don't have this digital noise. Cory Doctorow is just brilliant. And Rebecca, wow, what a treat. And yes, I neglected to tell her that the chat room was loving her hair. So she had a very cool hairstyle. All right, if you're in LA, get out there and go. All right, tomorrow I'm not sure what we're doing. We're working towards Wednesday and the next January 6th hearing. We'll see. We'll see what happens. I got stuff. There's all kinds of stuff. So maybe we'll just have a day with you and I. Wednesday, we'll have the hearing. Thursday, Howie. And then it'll be Friday again. Love it how that happens. All right, everybody. With that, we're done. I will leave you with the news. I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you for listening. And we'll do this. Oh, you know what? All right. I'm going to leave you with the news. But if you're watching on YouTube or the other streams, I'm going to bring up the NASA live feed of the DART, was it called DART, of the spacecraft they are going to smack into this asteroid. Okay, so we'll watch that. So watch out for the video, and I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
A hurricane watch has been issued for the west coast of Florida. Ian officially strengthened to a hurricane Monday morning with sustained winds of 75 miles per hour. The models keep shifting, but landfall is expected early Wednesday, somewhere around Tampa. This will be the first major storm to hit Florida since Ron DeSantis became governor. Meanwhile, cleanup is in progress in Nova Scotia, where former Hurricane Fiona made landfall Saturday with powerful winds and torrential rains. Fiona knocked buildings into the ocean, destroyed homes, and cut power to hundreds of thousands of customers before moving through New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and Newfoundland. Thankfully, no injuries were reported in Canada, but Fiona has been blamed for at least 16 deaths in Puerto Rico, where the situation is much more dire. Heated protests have erupted around Russia following Putin's announcement that he'd call up some 300,000 military reserves. Men aged 18 to 35 have been forbidden to leave and ordered to report for military duty. In regions including Kherson and Zaporizhia, citizens were forced to vote in a sham referendum that continues through Tuesday and would give Moscow cover to annex those territories that they're occupying. Before we leave Russia, this disturbing news item. At least 7 children were killed in a school shooting in the western Russian city of Zhivsk. According to the Russian state news agency TASS, 9 fatalities have already been reported. It's unclear if that number includes the attacker, who reportedly killed himself. Italy just elected its first female prime minister, Giorgia Meloni. Unfortunately, she also leads the most right-wing conservative government since Mussolini. The new 45-year-old prime minister is from Rome, described as deeply conservative, openly anti-LGBTQ, and is someone who's threatened to review same-sex marriage, which was legalized in Italy in 2016, and is raising fears about women's reproductive rights, as she's called abortion a tragedy. Lovely. Ironically, Miss Meloni is a co-founder of the anti-immigrant group called Brothers of Italy. All right. Well, the House is out today and tomorrow for Rosh Hashanah. The Senate returns Tuesday with a lot to accomplish in the remaining weeks, including fending off a looming shutdown. So they'll vote on a continuing resolution to keep the government funded and operating past Friday. But the holdup, there's always a holdup, right? And once again, it seems to be Senator Joe Manchin. This time, he's been trying to push through a bill reforming the permitting structure for coal-fired power plants that would likely negate most of the good climate policy that was passed in the Inflation Reduction Act. The Manchin part should come up for a procedural vote Tuesday night, even though senior Senate Republicans oppose the measure, as do many progressive Democrats. And also looming is legislation to ban stock trading by members of Congress and senior staffers. In the House, Zoe Lofgren is tasked with drafting the bill. And on Wednesday, the January 6th House Select Committee will convene another public hearing beginning at 1 o'clock Eastern. Though they haven't yet announced a witness list or topic for the session, Adam Schiff told CNN that the hearing could be, quote, potentially more sweeping than some of the other hearings. But it, too, will be thematic. It will tell the story about a key element of Donald Trump's plot to overturn the election, end quote. It's believed this will be the final hearing before the November 8th election, but Congressman Jamie Raskin has been pushing for more. We'll see. And finally, fans of Demolition Derby, listen up. Monday evening, tonight at 7:14 p.m. Eastern Time, NASA will smash a spacecraft into an asteroid. Seriously. It's part of a study of one method of planetary defense? Okay. So it's the DART mission, or Double Asteroid Redirection Test. It's the first of its kind. It'll test, quote, whether deflecting a space rock could one day protect Earth from a potentially catastrophic impact. All right. Here's more. The DART mission is targeting a space rock called Dimorphos. It measures 525 feet across and will send a spacecraft about the size of a school bus and has been traveling to reach its target since it launched in November of 2021, barreling toward the asteroid at 15,000 miles per hour. Telescopes will determine whether Dimorphos was nudged out of its regular orbit, which could be a life-saving feat if a major asteroid ever approached Earth. It's also carrying an imager that'll share a live stream of photographs as it nears the asteroid, providing a video-like experience for viewers. So the live broadcast will kick off on NASA's website. That's NASA, NASA.gov, beginning at 6 p.m. Eastern today. It'll last until 7:30 p.m. tonight. Now that's what I call demolition derby for the 21st century. Not very exciting. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Go to NicoleSandler.com and please click on that donate button. So those of you still watching the feed, I do have the NASA feed up. It is just right now, all you see is a little white dot right in the middle of the screen. And nothing's going to happen. The impact is supposed to come in an hour. So I'm not going to leave this up for an hour. So I will stop this and move on with my night. You can go and watch it yourself at NASA.gov. And then, here, I'll actually go back so you could see where you click. NASA Live, right? Official stream of NASA TV. Click on that. And oh, now it's more exciting than what I had before. It'll show up in a second. Hold on one second. Let's see if I can do it like this. So there is actually something showing on the screen now that, here it comes. My picture is a little behind. So you'll see it in a moment. You can see the NASA control room. You still only see the white dot in the middle. Live dark cam. All right. So apparently C-SPAN is carrying it too. C-SPAN 1. So go do your thing. Bring it up on the computer at NASA.gov or on C-SPAN and watch it. Because, hey, where else can you see a spaceship crash into an asteroid on purpose? All right. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a good night. Bye-bye.